This is a recording of a live Resolution Foundation event. We hope you find it some combination of interesting or entertaining. To read the research and access the event slides referenced in this episode, please visit the events section of our website.
Good evening. Welcome to the Resolution Foundation, both our audience here physically with us and also to our online participants. I'm delighted this evening to be in conversation with an old colleague in the Treasury and friend and person with a fellow shared interest in the generations, Andrew Scott, whose new book, The Longevity Imperative, Building a Better Society for Healthier, Longer Lives, is just published. I've already enjoyed reading it and strongly recommend it. A very interesting book. We will hear from Andrew in a moment. I might then ask a few questions, and then will be an opportunity for everybody else to join in. If you do want to join us with questions online, do go to Slido. You can access that from our website and start putting down your questions now. Now, Andrew is Professor of Economics at London Business School. He has written on this subject already with the 100-year life, and this latest contribution to the literature is particularly interesting and stimulating. Thank you very much for coming along, Andrew. Over to you.
My pleasure, thank you. And I'm going to go through a few slides. I'm going to stand up, and I've been told to stand there for the cameras, so that's why I'm standing behind the lectern. But thank you for coming here. And the book covers a huge amount of territory deliberately, because it's about life, and life is about everything. And I'm talking about changing how we live. So, of course, there's roams far and wide. But really what the book says is there's a major trend that I think we've got wrong and we don't focus on enough. We hear a great deal about AI and climate change, rightly. Those are obviously key things for our future. And we have impassioned debate about how we need to adapt and adjust. But I don't think we see enough debate about what I will call longevity, which is adapting to the length of life we now face. I say in the book, a first longevity revolution is coming to an end. We live in a truly extraordinary moment in human history where global life expectancy is now over 70. In other words, the young can expect to become the old. And that's global life expectancy. It's much higher in the high-income countries. And we just haven't got the institutions, policies, social norms, culture, etc., to respond to that length of life. And that's what we need to do if we're going to ensure that it's a good long life. And it's obviously a radical agenda, because for most of human history, we haven't expected the young to become the very old. And I'll come back to that again in a moment. So one of the aims is to try and get this longevity agenda up there with AI and climate change as a huge organising principle for how we think about our future. And it's sort of weird it drops off the radar, because it seems to me just blindingly obvious that one of the things that's going to influence all our future is how we age. But somehow it just drops off the radar and we talk about other things. The second thing I want to try and do is to sort of muscle to one side a little bit the ageing society narrative that tends to dominate all the debate. And in fact, you know, I got into this topic through giving a lecture as a macroeconomist about an ageing society. And you're sort of probably aware of the ageing society story. It's about the old age dependency ratio, how there's all these old people and they're a problem, they don't work, they need a pension, they get ill, and they're a burden on society. And I was halfway through this presentation, which is purely about a change in the age structure of the population. And there was a slide there that just caught my eye and said, on average, we're living longer and we're healthier for longer. I thought, wow. Sounds quite good news to me. How we turn this into sort of just solely a bad news story? And I think the challenge of the ageing society story is, one, it focuses only on a change in the age structure of the population. Falling birth rate, people living longer, younger cohorts are smaller, older cohorts are larger. That's important and it creates unique challenges, but we focus only on that. It's also remorselessly negative. We've sort of somehow defined old age purely in terms of decline. I think that's because we've medicalized it. And so as a consequence, we underestimate the capacity of later life, we underestimate the capacity of older people, and so we underinvest in it. And then, of course, we get problems with an aging society because we've excluded people from participating, we underestimate their capacity, we have ageism. The other problem is not just it's negative and doesn't recognise the complexity of how we age. Aging is characterised by great diversity. It also seems that we can't change how we age, that age is not malleable. And basically, we know that age is malleable. There are things that we can do to age better. And this is not me telling you that there's going to be a pill come out in a year's time that make you live forever. And, you know, there's just lots of things we know that make age malleable. And I'll come back to one of them later. One of them is just the inequality we see in health that shows that basically if you're in the bottom 10% of the income distribution, you age 20 years earlier than people in the top. And so we know that age is malleable. If we're living longer, we have to age better. So let me try and get this the right way around. There we go. It's the cover of the book. I did like the design. I'm going to say we had to be evergreen, and they've done a nice job of just putting green and a slightly optimistic take of things. But this is a story you'll know very well, and I kind of think demographers have done us a great service in pointing out this change that would happen, and a great disservice by then just stopping there. So this is a picture of the United Nations, the global population. You can see two things from it. One, this huge increase in the world population over time. I suspect it won't be as great as the UN says, but there we go. And the second thing is you draw a line at any arbitrary age, let's say 65, and you can see the big change in the population is both the number and the proportion of older people. The first time ever in human history, the number of people aged over 65 exceeds the number of people aged under 5. I never quite know what to make of that statistic, but anyway, you know, wow, there's a big change. We've never been here before. And as I say, this is, and certainly in economics, this is a problem. People stop work when they're old, they get ill, they need a pension, and the economy is going to hell in a handcart, and an ageing society is always seen as negative. To try and tell what I'm trying to do, I'm trying to sort of say, well, hold on, let's try and switch around, and I'm going to try and sort of draw an analogy with Malthus. So Thomas Malthus, there he is, a slight smile across his face, but his book is pretty miserable. Malthus says that there's a fundamental problem in human society. Population grows exponentially, the resources we create grows linearly, so there'll be all sorts of Malthusian checks. We're going to have famine, we're going to have disease, we're going to have war, and all these things are necessary to keep the population in check. And I don't want to get sort of too optimistic here, because of course we know we have very real environmental problems which are unsustainable at the moment, and that's partly to do with overpopulation. But Malthus was clearly wrong in some sense. I mean, he was smart enough as an economist not to give any numbers or dates to his forecast. He just sort of said, there is a limit. But when he was writing, the population was about 1 billion. It's now over 8 billion. So how did we end up sort of overcoming those Malthusian checks? And we sort of did it through a combination of ingenuity, investment, innovation, and new institutions. Basically, the Industrial Revolution. Now, of course, that caused huge changes and problems, but new ideas, new technologies, new institutions to support the Industrial Revolution meant we became much more productive, and we could support many more people. And we became so much more productive, we could actually spend even more money on health and education, which made us even more productive. And the reason I sort of focus on this is that, in a way, an aging society has a whiff of Malthus about it. It says we're living too long. We can't create the resources to support the length of life that we've got. And that this is a problem, the ageing society. How do we find the resources to pay for pensions, to pay for healthcare? And what I'm going to tell you is if you focus on a longevity society and focus on changing how we age by using ingenuity, investment, innovation, institutions, perhaps we can create those extra resources that are needed to finance. Basically, when the first time in human history the young can expect to become old, we've got to make sure that we grow old healthily and productive and in an engaged way. So rather than draw a horizontal line across, effectively what I'm doing is drawing a vertical line upwards. And if you draw a vertical line upwards, what you see is the thing that's changed is the young can now expect to become the old. And it's funny because I think people struggle with that concept. We always had old people and old people always young. The really big change is the young can now expect to become old. Last week when the book was launched, I did a radio interview which also featured Joan Bakewell, who I think is turning 91 this year. And I looked in the data, and when Joan was born, there was a 3% chance in 1933 of a baby making it to 90. If you look at the ONS data today online, the life expectancy calculator, they show that 50% of kids born today are expected to live into the early to mid-90s. So we've gone from 3% of the population expected to reach 90 to more than 50%. And I was given a metaphor about, you know, London and the rain. If there's a 3% chance of rain, I don't bother with a raincoat and an umbrella. 50% chance, I'm packing a raincoat and an umbrella. And as the probability increases, we've got to think about that future and invest more in it. We've never had to do it because it's been a minority occurrence, but that's no longer the case. So this is what I call the longevity imperative. It's a very simple syllogism. You are now likely to become old, and we fear getting old. That's what's at the heart of the ageing society story. We worry about outliving our health, our wealth, our skills, our purpose, our friendships, our sense of engagement. And so given that's now a very high chance of occurring, what do you do now to ensure that doesn't happen? And it's true, you can sort of work on how you age at any age. You know, 58, there are things I can do that will improve how I age, but the earlier you start, the better. And for me, an ageing society begins when you've got lots of people who are aged over 65, but a longevity society begins when you've got lots of people who will live to be over 65. And that's the key insight, I think, of this change. We've got to be evergreen. So we shift from a first longevity revolution to a second longevity revolution. We have to change how we age. And when I say change how we age, there's lots of parts of that. Some of that's about our behavior and our culture and our psychology. At 58, I need to behave differently from my father at 58 and my grandfather at 58, because I, on average, can expect to have more years, and so I've got to invest more in thinking about how I remain healthy and engaged. So some of it is about behaviour and culture, and of course, there are lots of things we know that, you know, we're told about diet and sleep and exercise, and those are things we've always known that work, but the incentive to spend time doing them has just increased. But there's so many other features as well, if you think about how we live our life. So I'll just sort of finish here with a key point. The book looks at sort of how we adapt as humans to this new reality, but in terms of sort of hardcore policy, we've got to achieve a three-dimensional longevity dividend. We already have these long lives. They're just not healthier for long enough. So we've really got to focus on making sure that health expands to match lifespan as much as it possibly can. We've also got to be productive for longer. And I'll come back to sort of how we do that, but of course, the ageing society story just says we're living longer, we're not healthier for longer, and we're not productive. So how do we tackle those? What are some of the policy issues? Well, first of all, on health, I would like a health system that really targets health. I think the government needs a target for healthy life expectancy. We cannot afford to intervene when people get age-related diseases. We've got to try and focus much more on preventative health. And we can talk about some of the things that are needed there, but that's about screening and early intervention rather than waiting to do operations. It's a focus on health and not on disease. Auden has a great quote, which is, the health is the subject that medicine knows nothing about. I rather like that quote. A cardiologist the other day, John Deanfield, said to me, no, health is just an incomplete diagnosis. You know, things are going to happen later on. And so lots to do with health. And then I'll just sort of say a little bit about being productive for longer. I think it's a great mistake to make this just about increasing the state pension age. Personally, I would make the state pension age contingent on healthy life expectancy. I would then make sure the government had an incentive to boost our health, because then they would make some money by increasing the state pension age. But at age 49, 50, 80% of people are in the labour force. By 65, which is before the state pension age now, only 25% of people are. So raising the state pension age does nothing to make us more productive. It just solves a government financial problem. It's what I call the Samuel Beckett approach to solving the problem. You know, I must go on, I can't go on, I will go on. That's kind of the state pension age approach. We've got to try and stop that massive fall in employment from age 50. Why do people leave the labour market from age 50 onwards? For a few, it's because they can afford to, but it's a minority. For most, it's because their health is deteriorating, they've got to care for someone who's unwell, their skills are out of date, or because of ageism in the workplace. And if we could stop that decline from 50 to 65, let's say we could half it. That's a 6% boost to employment every single year. And older workers tend to be more productive than younger workers on average. That's a really big economic dividend. It's the nearest thing I can see to an economic free lunch. So, you know, if I think about the issues the Resolution Foundation is interested in, where do we get productivity growth? It's older workers. 80% of UK employment growth the last 10 years is workers aged over 50. How do we keep their productivity high? Inequality, I said earlier, you know, aging is malleable. We found ways to make sure people age quickly, and that's by giving them low income and bad socioeconomic circumstances. So how do we tackle to age well? And then you know, David and the Resolution Foundation are rightly very keen on intergenerational issues. And actually, the ageing society is very much about the older people. But a longevity society is actually the young who had to change their life course the most. And how do you focus on those broad intergenerational issues? So, as I say, this is some of the huge issues that come about. Some of them are about the future of humanity in 300 years' time. Others about whether you should have breakfast tomorrow or not in terms of how you age. But I do want to say that this is a fascinating trend. Of course, I'm biased. I've written a book about it. It's an aggregate trend, but it's also the most personal of trends. This is about each and every one of us. So what are you going to do to be evergreen? So, thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, Andrew. And so just to start the conversation off, and it's, I'm going to relink it, as you were hinting at the end, to some of our own work at Resolution Foundation. And we've just produced this big economic inquiry on the state of the British economy and looking ahead to 2030. And one of the themes in that is that we are a low-saving, low-investment economy. Yeah. You might have thought that one of the effects of increasing life expectancy would be for people to want to save more for the future, for it to be a slightly more long-termist environment. And as we've both worked together in the monetary division of the Treasury many years ago, kind of, why are discount rates so high? Why is it apparently that even as Britain ages, our value of the future seems relatively low?
No, it is, and it's a good question, so I'm not sure I've got a good answer to it. But, it's interesting too, because macroeconomists say that when you've got an ageing society, the equilibrium long-run interest rate goes very low. So, of course, that means, yeah, you should be investing much more in the future. I would say it's a big problem we've got, because we've got to adjust our institutions to reflect our future, and lots of our institutions don't do that right now. So there's a high discount rate. There's also issues to do with government debt. So we've got a target that says debt can't go up in 5 years' time. If you want to spend on preventative health, you know, targeting people in their sort of 30s to make sure they're healthy in their 50s has a 20-year payback. I think there's lots of things that have a shorter payback, but it's going to be a really fundamental challenge. I'll flip it around slightly, though, because I think that the real challenge with... So if you think about us individually coping with a longer life, how do you deal with that challenge? One is to save more, but I don't think that's feasible. I think given the length of life we've now got, sort of high 80s, early 90s, if you look at the ONS numbers for newborns, I don't think you can save enough during the working career we've got. So how do we keep productive for longer? It's got to be about investing in human capital. So saving more is part of it, but it's really got to be human capital, health and skills. And that doesn't solve your problem, because the government still has a very high discount rate, but I think it's less about financial savings and more about human
right.
capital.
Very interesting, thank you. And then one other question, which is that you rightly distinguish in the book between kind of life cycle effects, how we all change as we go through the life cycle, and of course a lot of your book is about how the life cycle is expanding and indeed its shape changing. And then there are period effects, things that affect us all regardless of our age, like the financial crisis of 2008. And then there's thirdly, which generation you're in, which cohort you're in. And of course, my interest in the pinch was about the effect of being in one cohort rather than another. And I argued that the significant feature of the boomers was just we were a very large cohort, a period when there's a very high birth rate, and being a big cohort reshaped society. Jean Twenge, who's written about this a lot and has just brought out her book on generations, would say that, and you can tell she's from the West Coast of America, it's the technologies that are developed when you are young that you have access to throughout your adulthood that previous generations didn't help really reshape generations. And she focuses, for example, on social media and the impact that's had on the younger generation. How much, of course, all three matter. How much weight, and I think this is where there's probably some disagreement, how much weight do you attach to being in one generation rather than another? How distinctive do you think that the different generations are?
So I have a lot of problems with the generational labels, not that they're wrong. I just think they're often misused. So, for instance, I'm born in 65, so I'm either, Gen X or a baby boomer, because the year that classification date varies. So I'm completely schizophrenic. You know, some days I'm a Gen X, some days I'm a baby boomer. So I do worry about what I call demographic astrology, the notion that your character is pinned down firmly by the dates in which you were born. And I think baby boomers have a huge diversity, just as millennials do as well. So I think in the workplace, I'm particularly concerned about these discussions about, you know, how do we accommodate seven generations. For most of human history, we've just said there's young people, there's old people, and we haven't bothered with generational labels. And I kind of worry a little bit how we've gone down that route. That's not to say that what you're talking about isn't right. The aging society story is all about changing size of cohorts, and that's a dominating factor. I say, I think that distracts from looking at changes in how we age, which of course is ironic, because all the generation labels are saying the young are aging differently from us because they're part of a different generation. I think the technology stuff is important. By the way, I always ask my students, what is technology? And they sort of, it's one of those weird words, it's hard to define. The best definition of technology I've ever seen is one that says, it's all the stuff that doesn't quite work yet. I think that's brilliant. I still call my iPhone technology, but my kids don't because they're used to it. But technology is just the application of knowledge. And I think the hyper use of categories, you know, Gen Z, Alpha, is putting too much weight on technology. But clearly it is different. You can imagine where I'm going to come from. I think that what's missing in the generational labels, although your work doesn't miss it, is the changes in longevity. And, you know, I think, you know, I always give the example, my father was born in 1925. He was never a teenager.
Yeah.
You know, the word teenager is apparently first used in the New Yorker magazine in 1937. And I doubt my dad at 12 was reading the New Yorker magazine. He went to work at 14. And he's in a war at 17, he's married at 18, a kid at 19, a house at 20. I do all that mid-20s and my children doing it later. And I don't think that's anything to do with technology. I think that's to do with the lengthening of life. So we have to spend more time in adult development and education. And I think there's lots of good things about that. Again, you know, you're more likely now as a woman in your 40s to have a baby in the UK than under 20, which is a phenomenal turnaround. And then the other thing, which your work really picks up on and rightly emphasises, is what makes the young different is that, you know, my kids are different because they got me hanging around for a lot longer. And that's really going to change their lifestyle. When they get an inheritance, do they have to care for me? So I think we really underplay that emotion. So I think we can go too far in the generations. And then, you know, there's an interesting debate about older voters, for instance, which I touch on in the book. And there's a sensation that older voters just vote for what's in their interest, they're short-term because they're going to pass soon. And I think that's really wrong. I think we've got to just recognise people are people. And I think one of the really big dangers is seeing it as a young versus old generational fight, which I think the ageing society brings about. And so I think the simplest way of answering your question, sorry, it's a long answer because it's a good question, I haven't got a good answer, is that we underplay adjustments to the life course.
Right.
And that is a really fundamental problem because actually I think we're focusing a lot of our resources on catering for an ageing society, which is then creating the inequalities that we're going to see for the young, because it's incredibly important that the current generation of the young become the healthiest, most productive old you've ever seen. Because they're going to carry a fiscal burden for the current old and to have to finance themselves.
Yeah. I mean, ironically, in a way, and that's fascinating, what you are doing is you're adding another explanation about what makes different age cohorts different from each other. I say the size of the cohort matters a surprising amount.
Yeah.
Gene Twenge says it's really about technology. You're saying the different experience of the life cycle from different age cohorts itself is distinctive for them.
Yeah.
And so the life cycle for someone born as a baby boomer or someone born now is going to have a different shape. And certainly, as you rightly say, as a minimum, it's getting a lot slower.
Yeah.
All the big things get slower.
And some of that, by the way, I do think is, you know, I do worry about gerontocracy effects in the labour market. So the slowness is not just a choice. I think there's also blockages that come from that.
Yeah. Let us get some interventions here from the floor, and then I'll also take some online questions. We're doing well. You've stimulated a lot of discussion already. I'm going to collect several interventions in one go, and we have our excellent microphone operator with us. Let's start at the back, where I think there's someone who was at Resolution Foundation. So you get a special opportunity, George.
Thanks, David.
Is that me?
We're going to move to the front there. And so do give your name and organisation.
My name is George, but I'm very much just asking this in a personal capacity. Maybe as an XRF member. So, yes. To me, when I was working at RF, actually, the single most shocking stat is one that I ever came across, I think, is the one that you referred to on the inequality in life, healthy yes. life expectancy yeah. between the bottom and top yeah. Index of multiple deprivation. So a bit of a question as to has the... I assume that because that's index of multiple deprivation, there's going to be a correlation at birth between how deprived someone's background is and their healthy life expectancy. Has that changed over time?
Yes, I think it... Well, I mean, Steve Machen's done a lot of work on intergenerational equality in the UK and the US. I'd say it has got worse. I think, you know, again, I'm picking everything. As life has lengthened, inequalities compound more, I think. And some of that may be genetic, some of that may be environmental, some of it may be epigenetic, where, of course, the two start to sort of combine. There's also issues to do with work as well. I've done a lot of work on age-friendly jobs, and actually jobs in general become more age-friendly. But if you're working in a very physical job, you're going to age more quickly. And in general, physical jobs tend to go to those with lower education and hence lower income. So, you know, I think this is just another angle to expand on around inequality. Again, it's why I think we really need to focus on healthy life expectancy as an explicit target. I know it's not easy to measure, but neither is GDP, and we still sort of take a lot of attention on GDP. Because if you think about how we could try and raise healthy life expectancy, I would say it's going to, you know, most of us in the room are quite blessed in life, so that's good. But it's going to be pretty hard to immediately boost that. But I think there's things we can do to bring up those who are lower down.
Very good. Now, I'm going to take it as a bunch. These two questioners in the front, then I'll do some online, and then we'll move to the other side of the room. Yeah.
I'm David Wood from London Futurists. So I put my question in Slido as well.
Yep. Brilliant, solves that problem, right? We've got that question.
A lot of what you said resonates from what used to be said in the all-party parliamentary group on longevity. It was set up a few years ago. It said healthy aging is a critically important topic, and we're going to try and boost healthy longevity by 5 years by 2035, and we're going to address health inequalities. But it's been shut down.
Yeah.
Does that mean that somehow no good ideas come up, or... is there a chance that, as a result of your book, we're going to see a second coming of such an initiative?
And why don't you pass the question?
Old age has pension backing. So to some degree, the financial concerns are not as much as there, even though I would think that universal basic income for everybody should really solve the problem. But once the pension is there and all that, and the financial concerns are not there, what do you mean by productivity?
Right, I get in a lot of trouble for you, that word. Yeah, okay, good question. So let me take David's one about the APBG. I would love it if my book changed the world. That would be fantastic, wouldn't it? That would be good. I think we do have to recognize the centrality and the malleability of how we age, and it has to be key. I'm rational and I'm an optimist, and that's particularly hard to be right now because there's lots of problems in the world, aren't there? One of the things I stress about this second longevity revolution, this need to change how we age, I don't know how quickly it's going to happen, but it will happen. But, you know, no numbers, no dates, the kind of thing. But it's so apparent that, you know, that all these issues combine together. I think the challenge with longevity is whether it's a sort of horizontal or a vertical. It's spread across so many different departments. And we're so structured our life to what I call a three-stage life and our health system around intervention. It's going to take a lot of institutional change. But let me give you some reasons to be positive, although ironically they come from very bad things. The UK trend GDP growth is effectively zero right now. We've also got 3 million people, nearly 3 million people unemployed, long-term unemployed because of long-term health issues. And many of those are 50 plus. And I think finally people go, oh wow, you know, that's an interesting one. You know, that three-dimensional longevity didn't, because you know, if we can do something about people's health from 50 onwards and it's going to then lead to an impact in the economy, we get growth. And I think that's the penny beginning to drop, because I've spent all my career as a macroeconomist, monetary economics, fiscal economist. And the other thing that stunned me, it's only recently I thought, wow, health has first order effects on GDP. And if you study development economics, you know that because you focus on childhood. But as countries became richer, those countries, we just sort of thought, oh, well, that's just health. That doesn't affect GDP. But as we get the majority or ever higher proportion of the population aged over 50, we started to reckon that connection. And I think that could be the beginning of something. So I see much more talk about preventative health, whatever that might be. So I'm optimistic longer term. Your question on productivity, I'm an economist, so I use productivity actually very broadly. I would just say it's about being engaged, but there is a technical macro concept of productivity, which is working and producing. But let me come back to your point about the pensions. I think it's a mistake to see the pension problem as one about money. It's about resources. How do we get the resources to support more older people? And you know, we can get money, but money's got to come from somewhere. So actually this is really about how do we collectively as a population produce resources to support everyone who's alive. Well, UBI doesn't solve the problem. UBI is just paying money. You've still got to get the resources behind it. So this is why I stress productivity. If we've got the human capital to produce things, we could be self-sufficient, we could be in the marketplace, that's important. Now, I do think eventually that will be people working more and more later in life. I've got colleagues in their 80s who are working, and you know, as academics is easier. But right now, we've got lots of people who just aren't working from 50. Now, your point about UBI is an interesting one. Pension is kind of the nearest we've got to UBI. It's just everyone over a certain age gets it. I do think that as we, everything I'm saying is really saying, you know what, chronological age is not a good basis for policy. To say everyone over 65 is old and the same is just really wrong. It's wrong if you're negative about them, it's wrong if you're positive. So we might need to be a little bit more fine-tuned in how we think about things. And you know, in the book I give the obvious example, which is, was it over 60 you get a free Oyster card in London? I've still got a couple of years to go, but I'm looking, well actually I probably won't get it in the end. But that's a crazy policy, because lots of people, you know, cycle to the station, go to workers in the bank, earning large amounts of money. Age on its own, I think, is no longer a sufficient criteria. So we need to think hard about why we got pensions. That's not to say we should take it away, but we need to think very hard about why we're providing a pension.
We have got some other questions, and I would, if I may, turn to a couple online that do follow on from this. One question that we will put up is this: how we incentivize people to work for longer. This is a question particularly asking why about a 21-year-old entering the workforce, but it does also apply to economic inactivity amongst older people. And for what it's worth, our resolution analysis goes a bit... here we are. That's one question that we should focus on.
Yeah, really good.
And for what it's worth, our resolution analysis is that in Britain, unlike in the Bismarckian welfare systems, there isn't a retirement condition for collecting the pension. So people talk about it, and indeed, David, you talk a bit, Andrew, about a retirement age. There isn't a retirement age in Britain. There is no, you don't have to retire to collect a pension. And also the other sense of a retirement age, which existed still as an exemption from unfair dismissal. You had no rights to claim you had been unfairly dismissed when you reached the age of 65, until we abolished that age limit on unfair dismissal claims in 2012, which just happened to be the year when a million people born in 1947 reached the age of 65. So where there is no longer a retirement age. But what we do have is a lot of funded pensions, which you can access from the age of 55. And that's slowly going up. And you could argue that the economic, as we try to understand economic inactivity amongst older workers, the fact there's quite a lot of people with funded pension claims that they can access at the age of 55 is very different from a system more dependent on state pensions, and where you do collect your pension when you retire, but that age is 65 or something. So it's possible that our funded pension arrangement and the ability to access it a bit earlier has blurred our age of departure from the labour force.
Yeah.
But I don't know if you've got any observations on this.
No, I love this question. I think this is really interesting. And I'll come back to that question. I think it's great. I think it's the right way to look at the issue. But let me come back to your point. Yeah, retirement is sort of illegal, basically, as a sort of as a mandatory thing.
Indeed.
And in the book, I try to say the state pension age, which of course is the thing that then provokes people to retire. It's a bit of a mouthful, though, so perhaps I slipped every now and then. But of course, people then choose to retire. And I think there's a load of issues here. One is, I mean, it's an interesting word, retire, isn't it? I mean, it's obviously sort of a cliche now, but it's to withdraw, it's to retire. And actually, you know, the whole point about the book is if we're living life, we've got to be engaged for longer. Now, that doesn't mean you've got to be working for longer, but how do we find ways to keep people engaged? And I did reread Simone de Beauvoir's old age book, and she's just brilliant on this. She's angry because she says, you know, we just haven't got society a way to keep people engaged, and you're marginalised and excluded. And I think whether it's stopping work or being engaged and finding ways to do it, we've really got to work on that as a society. And if we underestimate the capacity of older people, we don't do that.
Yeah.
And then just on retirement, let me just pick up this. Sorry, I know it's a long one, but this is key. The essence of longevity is you've got more time, not necessarily good time. And we've got to think about how we use that time. In the 20th century, we took a lot of leisure after retirement. I think careers are going to get longer and we'll take more leisure this side of retirement. They could be starting work later, it could be career breaks, but it's also going to be about part-time work. And that seems to be the big way that retirement is changing now. It's a glide path rather than a screech.
Right. I think that observation has prompted a question there. So we'll go straight to the lady there and then we'll collect a couple of others as well. Yes.
Hi, thanks. So I wanted to make an observation really about productivity. I'm an economist as well, so I think we speak the same language. First of all, 11.5% of people over 65 are now working, employed or self-employed. A lot of that is part-time, a lot of it is self-employed, which points to the idea that to help keep people working as they get older, there needs to be more flexible options for working, not the 9-to-5, you know, drag into work every day.
Totally.
I mean, the pandemic may have helped people, shave people's perceptions of working. But the other thing I wanted to say about productivity is productivity as measured in GDP isn't the sum total of the value of older people to society.
Exactly.
We contribute a lot of unpaid labour, which is not counted in GDP. I'm talking about grandparenting, caring, volunteering, and so on. And this is a bit of a feeds into the negative narrative about ageing that I'd like to see.
And, you know, that over 65 old age dependency ratio, you're not productive. David Bloom at Harvard's done some great work on actually putting a monetary value on that non-market activity, which is huge. And yes, the rising participation rates are really important.
Yeah, I'm just going to call up here something that's come in online, which is almost an observation that just reinforces the point you're making. We've had, this is from Kay Allen of... Oh, right, of age irrelevance. I love it. Right, you're coming at it in a multimedia experience, this. We're getting people. Well, let me praise your question or observation. I don't know if we're going to get it up. The longevity imperative is a great way to move the narrative. How do we really stop the language of ageism and negativity and pivot to optimism, opportunity? Yeah. I want to flesh out on that.
No, it is. And you can, you know, it sounds like you can see exactly what I'm trying to do with this longevity perspective, because it unites everyone. And I think, you know, I was giving a talk to some Chinese MBA students at London Business School who were visiting, And I was talking about China's demographic problem, and you know, it's remarkable, the Chinese demographic change. Population goes from 1.4 to 1 billion, 45% of that 1 billion will be over 65. And I was saying to this bunch of 30-year-old Chinese people, how do you feel that in 35 years' time there's going to be so many people aged over 65? And I said, it's terrible. And they said, you know, the people get ill, they don't work. And I said, and who are these old people? And they said, well, what do you mean? They're old people. I said, no, in 35 years' time, who are all these people aged over 65? And they said, well, they're old people. I said, no, they're you. And it was quite remarkable, that sort of penny that dropped. And this is really at the heart of this challenge, because it's really hard when you're young to imagine you're going to be old. And that's just a psychological thing. It's easy when you're old to kind of look back and half remember when you were young, but not the other way around. And given the probability in the past the young have never become old, you can see why there's been that schism. So we need to change our language. And in the book, I try and sort of say, I mean, it's changing language is not going to be easy, but aging is just a horrible word. I mean, it's just, you know, the phrase aging society, no one celebrates an aging society, and we should. You know, it's fewer children to mourn. It's fewer parents snatched away in midlife. It's more grandparents meeting grandchildren. We say, oh, aging society. I mean, it's remarkably negative. We have to recognise that age is not an event. You don't suddenly become old. And it's a process. And if we can understand it as a process, then we can understand it's malleable and it unites us all. But wow, that's a really big change. But can I just go back to the age-friendly jobs? Because actually I think, yep, this is a really important issue, because I've done a lot of work with Darren Asimov and David Alter on this too, but it's not the case that older people working for longer creates unemployed amongst the young. It doesn't. But it does change the career prospects. And if we've got to create jobs that are much more appealing for older people, so they're prepared to do them at a lower wage, so we can kind of minimise the career impact. I think that's the other really important part of age-friendly jobs, not just to help people work for longer, which is really important, but to try and stop some of the sort of career progressions that might happen otherwise.
But isn't it also... Oh, sorry, yes, I think if you...
I'm sorry.
Question, and now I'm going to reinforce it. You intervene, Kay, and I'm going to call back up another comment as well. Yep.
Memory of Baroness Sally Greengross, who Fantastic. Created the AGB, yeah, on longevity. So 30 years ago, I worked at B&Q, and I created the over 50 strategy.
Yeah, yeah.
Why do you think that 30 years on, we're having to run a campaign called Age of Relevance? Because, yeah, employers don't understand that there's, yeah, the gift of extra time, whether, yeah, it's in the gig economy, yeah, whether it's in volunteering. So how do we shift it so that people see the gift of extra time as part of the economic added value for the UK? When we did it 30 years ago, the evidence is there, but employers are just not buying into the concept today.
They're not, and I think the challenge is when you bring attention to it, people react negatively to it. But let me go back to that stat. 80% of employment growth in the UK the last 10 years is workers aged over 50. So something, and there's definitely ageism, something is happening. And is it because we don't draw attention to it, or and when we do it, then becomes seen as a challenge? I think firms will start. Some firms will start to wake up to it, because of course there's just fewer younger people coming along. And as customers get older, they're going to start to see an advantage. But it's a really, really big problem. And the other really big problem with all of this is that most of the, you know, the idea that productivity declines with age depends on sector, occupation. But there's really not much evidence for that. But in lots of professions, wages rise with age. And I think that's a really big problem. Really, yeah, big problem.
And the sort of Edward Lazier work on the economics of retirement age is about retirement is constructed partly so as it reaches the point when people's productivity has fallen below their pay. I just wanted to come back though to this question, because the final sentence of this online observation: do you think it will become more common for people to take career breaks? Which you picked up on the thought: if you've got a longer working life, then you can have greater intermittency in perhaps how you work. When if we look at the evidence on women, you see the opposite pressures. Yeah. So that it looks as if, well, it is clear that now women have matching educational qualifications, matching labour market experience to men, up to the point when they have a child, at which point, when you withdraw from work for a time, it, yeah, can be hard to get back on, yeah, the career path. And indeed, as a result, women disengage from the labour force for shorter and shorter periods. So This does not suggest that the career break model is actually a way where you can shape your career. The most vivid example we have of this at the moment is that the career break when you've got a young child is actually something that people are increasingly wary of.
No. So again, I'll come back to this. So you're 100% right. I couldn't, and I guess I'll flip that around in a really optimistic way and say, so we've got to change the problem. And, you know, we've got more time. How do we use that time? And Claudia Golden's work is very good in this area, because what she points out is that if you want autonomy over your time, if you want to have flexible work, regardless of gender, you get penalised for a wage. You basically, we've designed work that says, here, you tell me what to do and when to do it. And that's a problem. And that's why we have this big wage penalty that is really a problem around families and childhood. So we've got to make working more flexible. And I'll just come back to the really optimistic long-run stuff. The 20th century, we designed so many of our institutions around time. We created the weekend in the 20th century. We created teenagers. We created retirement. We created the midlife crisis. And all these things we sort of take off as fixed, we can change. And I think that's how we have to adapt to a longer life. We've got to say, actually, I want to have more flexible working. Someone mentioned COVID as perhaps prompt us towards this. We got more technologies, more ways of working. And my kind of big hope is that if everyone at some point in time wants to have more flexible work, we'll then have to start to become more flexible. So, you know, it's going to be in everyone's interest, but it's going to take a while.
I do like your optimism and your belief that we should embrace malleability. And that's very wise advice. Now, we've got a question over at the back there. Yep.
I do think that the whole concept of productivity is crucial here, central here. And we've got to think about how narrow a definition we put on productivity, particularly from an economist's point of view. I've got a father who's got dementia, and he is basically is withdrawn from society. And part of that is, I think, not feeling productive in a broader sense, not feeling there's meaning in life. That accelerates that move into being, you know, isolated in a sense. So I think that is crucial. Now, I haven't read your book, but I suspect that productivity, and someone's mentioned it before, that is the crux of this. What do we mean by that?
Well, and first of all, sorry to hear about your father. It's a horrible disease, and I understand. My father-in-law is going through it and going through it, and it's enormously challenging. So I'm sorry to hear that. I actually kind of want to correct things. So it's really interesting being an economist to see how words get used in public, because actually, as an economist, productive is just I'm doing something with my time. And it could be anything. It doesn't mean necessarily producing measured GDP or getting paid a wage. And I couldn't agree with you more. You know, the secret of a good long life is to have a purpose, to feel engaged and to feel included. And we really have to work on this, because right now we don't. And actually, part of the challenge, I think, has been the three-stage life we created in the 20th century. And de Beauvoir says this. She says, you know, if all we do is tell people to save for retirement, get a hobby and choose somewhere nice to live, we're completely missing the point. And she says the problem with, you know, and she's obviously anti-capitalist, but she says retirement has taken away a role for older people. We've also got a society that is averse to talking about death and decline. And so we've really marginalised people. And I think that's a really, really important point to latch on to. So yes, we've got to think about productivity more broadly. But again, as an economist, that's fine. We can do it. It's just when we come to the GDP numbers. But there is something about the GDP numbers which is important, which is that it does produce money resources. And we can't completely ignore that, but we shouldn't do it at all.
And you touched on this briefly in the book, but there's also the neuroscience is quite important here. For a long time, we believed that you never created a new brain cell. You know, all those stories, every glass of whiskey you drank, you killed another few thousand brain cells, you never get any more back. And now we know that you do actually create new brain cells. And all the early years stuff, this kind of determinism, your brain is shaped by in the very early years, after which we can do nothing about it, is not correct. The malleability that Andrew is talking about so powerfully applies also to the way our brains work. They have, and if you'd set a new juggling trick for a 65-year-old and a 20-year-old, the evidence is that the reprogramming in the brain happens for both of them. If anything, there's slightly reduced manual dexterity for the 65-year-old.
Yeah.
But there isn't a neurological failure where the brain just automatically at 65 can't handle it. And I do think, and look here, we're both wrestling with these processes. I do think that the kind of pattern recognition part of experience, the even if it's not all fully at the front of your brain, if as you going back to the question of how you persuade employers, like what you fantastically and famously did with B&Q, which remains one of the few conspicuous examples, is when you've got lots of previous experiences roughly in this set shape to draw on, the pattern recognition helps. It makes sometimes it's a bit slower, but you have got so many related experiences from which you can draw stuff that the that I think just the sheer value of what people can contribute. I'm shamelessly talking our own book, as I'm known this, in the 60s.
But this all links together too, and I've got hands, but if I can just say, we've defined old age just in terms of decline.
Yeah,
and some things increase, and you know, there's never one age where you're best at everything in terms of your brain, and as you pattern recognition gets stronger, first principles gets less.
Yep.
And you know, the dementia is a prime example. It's not that there's everything's terrible about old age. It's not that everything's wonderful about old age, but we cannot just talk about it purely in terms of decline.
Now, there's a gentleman over there who's been keen to ask a question. Oh, and right, good, and we'll move back.
We've got a productivity issue to come up, I think.
Right. Right, we'll come back to you in a moment. You'll be very patient.
Very quick question. How do we need to change our education institutions? Yeah. Because older people are less and less in evidence in our colleges, our vocational skills, and particularly universities.
Yeah.
It strikes me we need to spend a lot more, either as individuals or as a country, on our education system. It's all become about young people.
I agree, and I think universities and colleges of education have a lot to do here, because they're going to wake up to that, oh, wow, I'm restricting myself to this market, which is shrinking, and there's all this market. I think it's going to be a challenge. I mean, it goes back to this point. You can learn. At the moment, most of the people who do adult education did lots of education early. So we've got a real challenge about how we make sure it's just another way of producing inequality. Also, older people learn differently from younger people. So it might not be colleges, although there's a really big increase in the states of older degrees and older courses, which I think we're going to take off. But I think the other thing with health and education is so much is going to have to happen outside of the health and education sector. It could be a YouTube video, it could be a short clip. And so the question is, how do we make sure that, again, that's equally spread? But I, you know, both with health and education, David Cutler at Harvard has a great saying about the health system. The most underused person in the health system is the patient. You know, the patient goes to us, I'm unwell. The doctor says, I think this is what you've got. I've examined you. I've given you this. But there has to be a lot more that we do. And of course, that's going to be a challenge, because it's easy when you've got resources to do things. But how do you make it easy for everyone to partake in that?
And I think one of the most interesting accounts of the extraordinary economic surge post the Second World War is the argument that the GI Bill, when you had people who already had really important life-shaping experiences, who then came back and surged into higher education, and Britain had a tiny version of it, actually. It wasn't as ambitious as it should have been. So those people were particularly benefited from education. They came a bit later. And if you'd already fixed a Jeep under fire in Normandy and then came back and studied engineering at university and then went out into life, what you contributed to the American economy was just amazing.
Yeah.
And that was because for a period there was it was both a very significant increase in higher education and for people a bit older than conventionally. And we didn't fully take advantage of that opportunity. Didn't we? Right, now we've got some questions down here. The gentleman in the front row, and then, yes.
Hi, I'm James from the Department of Levelling Up Housing and Communities. And I've got a question about, can we learn something about the culture and social values of what I think are called blue zones, these places in the world where people live surprisingly long lives? Do you think it's worth looking at that for how our people in the UK can live better for longer?
So I got a real conflict now. So Dan Button, I know, and I think Danny's great. I think he's done a great service to the blue zones. I think anything that gets people to say, hey, wow, this is something positive, it's important for me to do, and this is what I should do, is great. And if you look at the blue zones and what they encourage, it's about community, it's about purpose, it's about inclusion. All those things are absolutely right. There is something about the human mind that kind of always wants to have like a Shangri-La that sort of says, oh, there's something great. And there's an interesting academic paper about the blue zones, which I hate to mention. But it says there's something else the blue zones have got in common, which is bad record keeping. And so actually there probably isn't an unusually high number of centenarians in these places. Japan, for instance, had a ridiculous number of centenarians. And the government then said, well, let's do a check because we're paying out a lot of money in pension payments. And they discovered there was a lot of fraud going on. And actually, in the end, there were a lot, but nowhere near as many as we thought. So it's a rather unromantic way of looking at the blue zones. But it goes to the heart of actually what it's about. And you know, I think what's interesting about blue zones compared to perhaps the sort of bioengineering stuff is it says what matters. And I think it identifies things that really do matter.
Now, we've got some people who want to come back for a second. I think everybody had their hands up for once already. So let's collect these two follow-up interventions. Yep.
I'm sorry you had
to. Yeah, that's all right. No, it's fine. Then
old age wisdom, this is about productivity again, I must say that. And to tell him that, I'm a new grandfather. Giving the huge hug to my grandson is the most productive thing I have done in my life.
Completely.
So 0 to 25 years of your life is learning. 25 to 50 is social and economical interactions. 50 to 75 is retirement to look back on your life. And 75 to 100 is just going to think about your afterlife. That's the age-old wisdom, I'm told. What happens is, when I saw that other question about a 21-year-old wanting to work in the workplace and all that, if a 50-year-old is in the workplace, that is taking away the space for that 21-year-old.
Right. Well, that's we're going to
lady next to you.
We're going to have the lady next to you. We got your challenge, all right?
Sorry. I should have said who I was last time. My name's Karen Hancock, and last year, I finished a PhD at the age of 68. On the title of it was "What Makes Life Worthwhile in Older Age," so it's a topic on which I know a lot about the research evidence. But one of the things I wanted to say is there is evidence that purpose in life, which is one of the features of eudaimonic well-being. There is good evidence that it declines in older age.
Yeah.
And one of the things that helps purpose in life is having goals, having things to do, having a reason to get up in the morning. Well, it's a sort of definition of purpose in life, really. But we do know that the evidence on work and health is that working, good work, not any old work, but good work is good for your health. It helps you to live longer. And retirement can be very bad for your health, depending on retirement. So I suppose what I wanted to say is one of the things that we need to think about is the interaction between good work and health, which will help improve output, GDP and productivity and so on. And the other thing is to think about how we, I agree about lifelong learning, you know, I'm an example of it myself. But I also agree about the denigration of older people's skills and abilities. I was reading a research paper the other day, which was about how older people's physical strength declines with age. Well, that's true, but you can allay it with strength training, but also talking about how their cognitive abilities decline with age. And the test they used for this was tests of memory, like how many words. But that's complete negation or complete misrepresentation of the kind of things that older people are really good at that younger people are less good at, which is kind of synthesizing knowledge and emotional resilience. Sorry,
completely.
I'm quite angry about it.
No.
Even this is published in a respected research, you know, a peer-reviewed journal, very ageist interpretation of age in a peer-reviewed journal.
And I'm going to throw in a third question, which is from Len Cook. I think this may be the Len Cook who was the national statistician. It goes back to the previous question as well. He doesn't fully explain it, but it's about different forms of contribution at each life stage. And let's, just in the last few minutes, you might want to, we had a sort of four life stages neatly balanced up into four 25-year-old stints, and we've also had some challenges about what we might assume about older people, and Len's observation as well. Do you want to help us make sense of this.
Yeah, and you and I talked at the end of the book. I just really focus on relationships as the key thing in all of this, and I think, you know, there are lots of things that have been said which are absolutely right. So, you know, we're trying to get intergenerational mixes so we can get the use of older people's skills, the younger people's skills, which is the most innovative way of doing things. And we're not very good at that at the moment. On the four stages of life, In the book, I quote someone who says, American comedian, "I'm going to live forever, so far, so good." I'm 58. I have no idea what the purpose of life beyond 58 is. I'm still trying to work it out at 58, to be honest. I think the really important thing is we've got to now recognise that with the majority living longer lives, we do have to be productive in the sense of creating resources to support a longer life more. And it, when a few people reach that age, we could relax more. But now when everyone does, we have to be more productive in a resource way. But I think we've also got to be non-prescriptive in how people age. There's a concept of successful aging, which I really understand why people push that. And Jack Rowe, I think, is great with it, because we want to age well. But actually, ultimately, we just got to say to people, do with the time what you want to do. And if you let people have that as an option, they can choose what they want to do. We don't say people have a successful middle age. We don't say they have a successful adolescence. So we just got to provide people with the resources and the options at whatever age they do the thing it is that they find most meaningful. And I hope it's that wisdom. I hope it's giving back. But, you know, if it's not, that's fine.
We're going to squeeze in one last question here. Yes, from Mr. Wood.
Thank you. I wanted to get back to the subject of institutions, because you had this remarkable slide at the beginning. How did we overcome the crisis that Malthus foresaw? Yeah, ingenuity, innovation, but also institutions. Yeah. So do you have recommendations for changes in institutions, or even new institutions, that will help us to have this successful evergreen economy?
I don't think it's necessarily a major social creep, by the way. So I think we've already got a Department for Work and Pensions, we've got a Department for Education, a Department for Health. I think we just need to think about it differently. And clearly one of the really big things that needs to change is the health system. The health system based around intervention is not going to work when we've got ageing-related diseases. So I would say that's, to me, the one that really, really has to focus on keeping people healthy for longer. I think that is a big change. But again, all the other things we talked about, retirement, it's an institution. It's already evolving, it's already modifying. It needs to be much more flexible so that if you are someone, say an academic who wants to work till you're 90, you can do. But if you are someone working in a very physically demanding job and you don't want to, then you've got options to do other things. And I think it's those sort of institutions. But I think the biggest change is cultural, which is recognising that we can't underestimate the capacity of later years and later life. Or if we have this horrible doom loop where we underinvest in later years, we exclude older people, and we get the very outcomes that we fear. But in the other stuff, it's sort of, I think we kind of know what to do. It'll be just extensions and change. It's the mindset, I think, is the biggest one.
Thank you very much indeed, Andrew, for being with us this evening. Thank you for your reflections on all this, which we've greatly enjoyed. Thank you to our participants, physically here and online.
Thank you for listening to this Resolution Foundation event. You can find more episodes and the latest living standards research on the Resolution Foundation website.